You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras, the National League West. I'm Allison Twitter from MLB.com, and while we thought that the competition in the race, the division title, the NL West, would go down to the last weekend of the season, this thing might be decided before the weekend gets here. So it's been a battle all year between the Dodgers and the Giants. The Dodgers have handled business as they needed to with the Giants. All you have to do is just keep winning when you sit on top of the division. And if you keep winning, you don't have to worry about what anybody else is doing. So the Dodgers seem to be primed to capture the division, and they have a very healthy Clayton Kershaw, knock on wood for the Dodgers, who missed the first month of the season and could possibly have that working in his favor and in the Dodgers' favor in October. So it will be a very interesting road as we start October and expected things from the Dodgers. I am joined by my colleague Ken Gernick, who has covered the Dodgers all season long for MLB.com, and we are almost at the finish line as far as the regular season goes. So the Dodgers appear primed to be in a very good position. And actually, by the time that you all are listening to this, they may have clinched the National League West division behind their ace, Clayton Kershaw. So we'll have to see about that. But Ken, let's talk a little bit about some things that have happened lately. I don't think that anybody thought that the Dodgers and Giants series would be quiet or subdued or boring. And it's lived up to the hype. So let's just talk a little bit about what's going on between these two teams. Tempers flared a little bit. Madison Bumgarner hit Yasiel Puig with a pitch. Benches in the pen emptied. Nobody got hurt, of course, because nobody ever throws any punches in these things. But what was going on with that? And was it just one of those things that happens and they kind of move on from it? Or do you think it'll linger a little bit?
Well, it really started back in May when the Puig homered off Bumgarner and flipped his bat. Bumgarner didn't like it and was yelling at him as he rounded the bases. And he continued to yell as he got to home plate. So this has some history, and it'll probably happen again. And when they face each other again, I don't know if it's so much the teams involved, but Puig has the ability to anger and infuriate any team. It doesn't have to be a rival from up north in California way. So. This will continue because of the way Puig plays the game and his personality. And he does irritate opponents. He sometimes irritates teammates. But this is what you get. You get the whole package. It's a phenomenal tool. And he doesn't play by the unwritten rules of Major League Baseball. So the fans seem to love it. You know, they love the controversy. He loves the limelight. So I don't see it changing.
How does Don Mattingly handle all this? I'm, you know, reading a few things just here and there about, I mean, that's a challenge for a manager, just to kind of handle the kind of boneheadedness, for lack of a better word, of some of the players, trying to make sure they understand that there are certain things that they should be doing, but while portraying that to the media in a completely different way and maintaining harmony in the clubhouse. Is Mattingly good at that? Would you say that's a strength of his?
Well, it must be if they're going to win back-to-back divisions with the amount of egos and personalities that they have. It's probably the toughest part of his job, even worse than dealing with the media. And Puig is the lightning rod. He's out of all the egos and all the potential problems that that Donnie has, Puig's the biggest one, and he's proven that over the 2 years. But like I said, you take the whole package, and there's a lot more good than bad there. Puig can do things on the field that no one else can do. So Mattingly knows he needs him to win, and he does whatever he can to keep him happy. And last night it was to keep him in the game by getting in front of him and trying to calm him down. Every manager has different responsibilities depending on his situation. And Donnie's is dealing with these egos. If he's no good at it, he won't last. So because this team is full of egos. So. That's his biggest responsibility, and I'd say if you go by the bottom line, and they're winning 2 years in a row with all of these big names and big salaries, then he must be doing a pretty good job.
Let's look ahead to the postseason a little bit, just with the starting rotation. Ryu being unlikely to make any more appearances before the postseason. Left shoulder inflammation, but how worried are they? I mean, it seems like they're pretty confident that if he just rests and then he'll just be able to just slot into the rotation when the playoffs start, but there has to be a little bit of concern that maybe he's not going to be available once that starts. What's the deal? What's going on with him?
Well, yeah, but there's nothing to do about it. They just have to wait. So you can't go out and make a trade or anything. So, yeah, they're concerned. I think they're more concerned right now with their bullpen. But, you know, Ryu, if he can't pitch, it does have a domino effect on the bullpen. So there is some concern for sure, as there would be any time you've got one of your top three starters out, you know. But there really isn't much they can do other than hope that he continues to progress. He's been making progress, and since the inflammation's gone, he's starting to play catch, and hopefully he'll get on a mound in the next few days and have a bullpen session and be able to go. The fact that there's so many off days between now and when he would pitch, he has almost 2 weeks to continue his recovery before the third game of the first round of the playoffs, assuming that the Dodgers win their division and are on a wild card. So there's time, but there will be some scrambling if he can't do it. Dan Heron would move up. It probably would require having Roberto Hernandez on the postseason roster. He probably wouldn't make it if he was healthy. But, you know, that's really getting almost 2 weeks ahead of ourselves. So right now they're cautiously optimistic that he'll be able to go.
Yeah, that's the one thing about the playoffs is you really just need three strong starters. You don't need the entire five-man rotation, certainly to get through those early games. But, yeah, this is probably not good timing. But like you said, I mean, there's nothing they can do about it, so they have to keep pushing forward. So what about the I mean, you talked a little bit about the bullpen, the concerns there. Let's talk about that a little bit. But I also wanted to touch on the outfield situation. There seemed to be a lot of outfielders trying to gun for playing time, but also a spot on that 25-man roster. So, you know, there's been some speculation. There's six outfielders. There's probably just five spots. How do you see that shaking out? And remind me if Peterson is actually eligible for the postseason roster, because I can't remember when he came up. So how does that all kind of shake out in the outfield?
Well, Peterson is eligible, but he's unlikely unless somebody gets hurt. I mean, he wasn't part of this team that got him to first place. And he hasn't really been much of a part. He's been an extra piece during September. So I don't think you would see him making the roster ahead of an Andre Ethier when Ethier is the one who's been their left-handed bat off the bench all season. Now, if somebody was hurt and they felt they needed his defense, that would change things. But as it is right now, I think it would be a long shot for him to make the roster. And one of the problems that they have is because they always take Hanley Ramirez out for late-inning defense, they have to keep Miguel Rojas on that roster just to play a couple innings when they're winning. So that ties up one more roster spot that maybe they would be able to give to a young player like Peterson for an extra bat off the bench. So the way the roster is constructed now, I don't see Peterson making it unless something weird happens. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask you about the bullpen. So what are some of the concerns there?
Well, the concern there really is Brian Wilson. That's the biggest concern. But that's nothing new. It's been this way all year. He's had an ERA of almost 5 most of the year and throwing barely 90 miles an hour, you know, on a good day. So he's not what Brian Wilson was with the Giants, and he's not what Brian Wilson was with the Dodgers last year in September. As a result, and he's being spot used not facing any left-handers. So what Don Mattingly has had to do is he uses both Wilson and J.P. Howell in the eighth inning to get to Kenley Jansen, and he'll move him around depending on whether he's got righties or lefties coming up. And it's had mixed results. So it's kind of dicey. I think you're seeing now that Pedro Baez is a rookie and only been up for 4 or 5 weeks. He's getting a lot of seventh inning action, and it wouldn't surprise me if he winds up in the eighth. So this bullpen is one in flux. They've got four former closers, but I don't think they're really comfortable with any of them, including Brandon League and Chris Perez, J.P. Howell, Brian Wilson. So it's a mix-and-match situation, and he keeps his fingers crossed that he can get the ball to Kenley Jansen with a lead.
Does it surprise you at all? I mean, just to see sort of, like you say, things are in flux. There seems to be just a lot of question marks in a lot of different areas. And, you know, traditionally, when you look at teams that are making a really strong push in September and have a, you know, are kind of considered pretty favorable to get far into October. Usually, the injuries are very minimal, and guys are solidified in a particular role. It doesn't seem to be with the Dodgers situation yet. They're at the top of the standings, and they seem to just be rolling. I mean, does that surprise you at all?
Well, everything with the Dodgers is surprising. You know, you can start with the payroll, and they
right.
go out and buy every big name, big money guy out there, and to get to that status in your career, you're basically a veteran, and with a lot of miles on you, and that's what the bulk of their team is. They've got a bunch of 30 plus guys, and especially out in the bullpen, you don't get to be a former closer by just being young and fresh. You've proven that over the years. And as a result, a lot of them, aren't as sharp as they were 3, 4, 5 years ago. So you've got a veteran team, and at times an old veteran team, and they break. Veterans break, and so you've had a lot of injuries that they've had to overcome, and they overcome it by the fact that they've got a very deep roster because money's no object. So this is it's not a surprising team, but it's a very unusual team by the way it's constructed.
Yeah, I still think that Clayton Kershaw missing that first month of the season is going to work in the Dodgers' favor. And I think that was a difference maker last year, was that he wasn't so great in October. And I don't know. I have a feeling about the Dodgers this year. So we will keep our eye on it. Thank you so much, Ken. Appreciate all of your help through the regular season, and we'll talk to you in October. I am here with my colleague Chris Haft, who covers the contending Giants for MLB.com. And although we are still a few days away from the regular season ending, this race in the NL West may not come down to the last weekend of the season, but I think that we're going to see both the Dodgers and the Giants in the playoffs, and the Giants look to be more looking at the wild card than anything else and are going to fight for home field advantage in the wild card game, which I would guess would be pretty huge. But the Giants, like every team, have had a few setbacks, and one of the biggest ones, and I'll bring in Chris Haft to talk about this, is Angel Pagan. Chris, we've talked about it many, many times, what a different team this is with Angel Pagan and without Angel Pagan. And unfortunately for the Giants, they're going to have to figure out how to be a better team without him because he is out for the season. He's going to have some back surgery. So the numbers that everybody's talking about, of course, 56-35, the record with him, 29-36, the record without him. So how devastating is this for the Giants just heading into the most exciting part of their season?
I don't know if devastating is too strong a word, but although I guess maybe it is, devastation would imply that they really can't do anything, and it's definitely a blow to their postseason hopes. But it's a cliche, but a lot of different people will need to step up. Obviously, the guy who's going to be in Angel's role, Gregor Blanco, playing center field and leading off, he obviously is going to have to pick up his game and keep it there, play at a level that maybe he's unaccustomed to, frankly, for long periods. For short periods, Gregor can do the job, and defense never slumps, and he will be fine defensively. It's offense that's going to be a question. And the other night, when he hit a leadoff home run and hit a key double in the 13th inning of a win over the Dodgers in the opener of this current series, that was the kind of stuff they would get from Angel, and they're going to need more of that from Gregor. However, that leaves a void in left field with Gregor playing center field, and I don't think even Bruce Bochy knows how he's going to fill that hole. It would be occupied by Michael Morse normally, but he has his own injury problems, strained left oblique. And the Giants really don't know if they'll have him available for the postseason, whether it's a one-game postseason or going on to the division series if they can beat Pittsburgh in a wild card game. And so because the offensive firepower is somewhat diminished, you better have better pitching. So it's not just the hitters who have to step up. It's really the pitchers too.
And what do you think about the pitching going into the postseason? There's been so many. I mean, it just seems like a lot of teams, even the contenders, and maybe even especially the contenders, everybody seems to have some issue with their pitching, whether it's an injury, whether it's inconsistencies in the bullpen, wherever. There are teams that are soaring through September and are, on the right track and sort of getting that momentum going, but it seems like a lot of teams are just trying to stay afloat and limp toward the postseason. Where do you see the Giants pitching fitting into this whole equation?
I'd categorize them as the stay afloat category. Madison Bumgarner, despite his loss last night, has performed this year at number one starter quality, or just below. That there's no doubt about that. He's an all-star, may continue to be a perennial all-star. But other than that, Jake Peavy's done great lately. Jake Peavy's second half reminds me of Tim Hudson's first half. I mean, Tim Hudson looked like a Hall of Famer in the first half. It was just ridiculous. He looked like, at age 38, he looked like he discovered the fountain of youth. However, in the second half, his last two starts, he's been torched in the first inning. So, you wonder if he wasn't half serious when he was saying in the first half, I'm doing it with smoke and mirrors. And if that happened to him, what's Peavy surviving on? He's won, he's 6-1 in his last seven decisions, which is awesome for the Giants. But can he keep up that pace? I mean, besides Bumgarner, there's really nobody truly. I don't know if you can really hang your hat on somebody unless it's Peavy. And again, is that for sure what he's doing? Ryan Vogelsong has actually pitched better than his numbers. He's just pitched an awful luck. So. Would his luck change if he got into a postseason situation? Who knows? And Yusmeiro Petit, I mean, he has pitched, had some impressive moments obviously lately, but there's a reason why he's been a journeyman for most of his career. So starting pitching is a big concern for the Giants.
And you bring up Hudson. I mean, that's Tim Hudson. That's no small thing. I mean, because you always worry, if it's a younger guy, you worry that maybe he's just getting fatigued. When it's an older guy, you wonder if he's just, he's getting old. So that's got to be a big concern that he's just been so ineffective at this point in the season. That's not what they're needing.
No, they don't want to. Every team, I think, wants to go on an upswing, heading toward the postseason. And that's why Bruce Bochy and the players have almost repeated this mantra. We just want to win tomorrow's game, get things back in order and, take it from there. And so, they still haven't clinched. They need either a Milwaukee loss or to win tonight. And winning tonight against Clayton Kershaw, nothing more needs to be said there about the difficulty of that task. So they're just left trying to repair their game slowly but surely each day.
So this Dodgers-Giants matchup, I mean, I think that nobody's been disappointed as far as the people that wanted to see intensity and rivalry and everything that goes into a September battle with your division rivals. It's not really gone so much in the Giants' favor, both matchups, both series this month. But the temper's flaring. I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised. The Baumgartner and Puig sort of confrontation, I mean, that doesn't shock anybody. Do you think that's sort of just the heat of the moment thing, with everything on the line and the rivalry between these two teams and the Giants maybe being a little frustrated that this far back in the standings heading into the last weekend? I mean, what was your impression when you were watching all of this happen?
All of the above, Allison, and maybe a few other things, maybe a little history there. Puig hit a home run off Bumgarner in a May 9th game and, had a kind of theatrical type bat toss after he made contact and ran the bases real slowly, and Bumgarner walked toward home plate, screaming at Puig. So they've been antagonists for a while, and so then last night, even though I do believe Madison Bumgarner when he said he wasn't trying to hit Puig intentionally, I mean 0-2, run already in, he wants to get out of the inning, he doesn't want to put more base runners on. And as Madison also said, if I wanted to hit him intentionally, he'll know. So
right.
Madison's got great control. He averages about 2 walks per 9 innings. So he'll plunk Puig in the back or the buttocks or someplace where it's not gonna put him out for put him on the disabled list, but it's gonna hurt. But this rivalry is still intense. It's I was talking to another reporter last night who said, yeah, maybe this because they haven't really finished 1-2 that many times or as many times as one might think offhand, maybe this rivalry isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Well, I wasn't going to get into a big long discussion with him, but I think he's wrong. I think it's been a great rivalry for decades. It's going to continue. And stuff like this, even though maybe some people think it's a little childish, Bumgarner and Puig, it's good for the rivalry. It's going to sustain it. It's going to make people, you know, tune in or listen, whatever. When Bumgarner pitches against the Dodgers, it's fun.
Yeah, it's a lot. I don't know that it's childish when you compare it to, like, the absurdity of the swimming pool controversy with the D-backs last year. I mean, that's the stuff that just makes your eyes roll and your stomach turn if you're sort of a traditional observer when it comes to being a baseball fan, where you're like the actual, you know, on the field things that happen. I think that everybody sort of takes it for what it is. And that's just that these two teams are really good right now. This is probably kind of a renaissance for this rivalry. I mean, Yankees and Red Sox, my God, I was just thinking about it. I'm like, I'd take this rivalry over that one any day.
I think what gives what has made Yankees-Red Sox the uppermost in a lot of people's minds is the fact that they have met in the postseason, and that's kind of, you know, enhanced the rivalry a bit just because of the nature of the playoff postseason systems that, and maybe the fluctuations of their fortunes. The Giants and Dodgers have not met in the postseason. There's a slight chance that will happen this year. And that, I'll tell you, if they did meet in the postseason, I think you could take an average Giants-Dodgers game, not that there's any such thing as an average Giants-Dodgers game, and you know, multiply the intensity by 10, and that's what you would have if they met in the postseason. I think it'd be great.
No, it'd be awesome. Oh, man, I'd pay money to cover that series. Bruce Bochy, he's like the perfect guy to be – he's a great manager. He's obviously had a lot of success. He's won a couple of World Series. But when it comes to just, you know, players maybe getting a little tense, I mean, you see, you know, you've been hearing a lot about guys that are sort of thinking and acting slightly irrationally for things that they really don't need to be bothered with right now. And it's nice to have a guy like Bochy who, I mean, I don't know, you talk to him every day. Does his demeanor ever change, or does he just kind of have that same sort of monotone delivery when he's just giving you the information?
Yet the monotone remains a monotone. Our friend Henry Shulman of the San Francisco Chronicle asked him a question kind of relayed from a Twitter follower last week about maybe playing Gary Brown, the rookie who was number one draft pick in 2010, maybe playing him a little more. And Bruce got a little fired up over the nature of that question. But now he's turned it into like a running joke. You know, instead of seething over it or, clamming up over it, he's had a little fun with it. He's cut down his pregame interview times maybe a little bit, but that's because he's kind of focused, and we've accepted that. He really is, though, as you were implying, you know, cool under fire, the kind of guy you want as your leader if you're a ball player. So. It's been. In situations like this, he's definitely an asset. If they manage to make the postseason, which it looks like they will, but probably as a second wild card, he'll be an asset there. Even in a one game situation, he'll be able to get. He always seems to get the most out of his players, whether they're subpar type players or all stars.
Yeah, I mean, he's loved by everybody. He's respected by everybody. Maybe not everybody, but by most people in baseball. And there's reasons for that, you know. Guys that have longevity, I mean, that's not a fluke, because they're good in these situations. They know how to win. So, anyway, Chris, thank you so much, and good luck in the playoffs. And I'm sure if the Giants continue on, then we will continue to talk to you. Thank you very much. My colleague Richard Justice caught up with Corey Brock, who covers the San Diego Padres for MLB.com, and they discuss what the Padres need to do this offseason and heading into spring training next year.
So, Corey, a tumultuous year, a disappointing year on a lot of levels. The Padres have a new general manager. When A.J. Preller gets going in the offseason, I'm sure he's already going on the offseason, what are his top priorities to get the Padres competitive?
Yeah, I kind of gave someone asked me this the other day, Richard. I kind of gave a glib answer that it was offense, 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 and then when he gets to it, maybe some more offense. But this has kind of been an area that has been troubling for the Padres for many years. You know, this is a franchise, at least in my 8 years, you know, been built on run prevention, pitching and defense, and, you know, building up the bullpen and getting a lot of innings and quality work out of the starters and scratching out a few runs to kind of make it all work. Well, you know, it sort of besieged this year by some injuries and also by some underperformance that really buried them early in the year and kind of been digging out of the hole ever since. So we've seen some better play as of late in August and September, but a little too late. So I think, you know, the challenge moving forward is to find some, you know, the eternal pursuit for big bats is what everybody wants. But, you know, I don't think you have to go out and land, you know, marquee players here. I think you can make some modest moves to improve the offense. You know, and the Padres are never going to be a team that trolls too heavily in the free agent market, certainly because of the financial component involved. And, you know, this may mean moving some starting pitching. You know, you certainly have to give up something to get something. So it's going to be an interesting winter, especially the first offseason for new general manager A.J. Preller. But, you know, I think that one of the benefits of hiring him in early August is he's had, a pretty good sample size, of looking at this major league roster, what's there, what's not there, and getting a good idea of what he wants to do moving forward.
As you've looked at the team, where are their strengths? I mean, Grandal, a catcher? I mean, Jerko has had an up-and-down year. Seth Smith, obviously, they signed him to an extension. Where is the places they would like to upgrade? Or are they open to just, hey, whatever's out there?
I think on the pitching side, they're in good shape, and the rotation and the bullpen, I think that's in pretty good shape. You know, there'll be some tweaks there. And like I said, they may have to move a starting pitcher to get a bat to get some help. But, you know, looking at their position player grouping, Richard, it's, you know, there's a lot of guys out there that could either probably start in AAA next year or could be platoon guys. So, you know, Seth Smith had a nice year. The last 2 months haven't been that good. But he still profiles as a platoon guy, a guy that's killed righties. But, you know, you can't start him every day. Certainly against left-handed batters. Some other guys that have fallen well below what their career marks have been. Jed Jerko kind of had a disastrous second year in the big leagues. He's bounced back a little bit in September, but, you know, they would like for him to swing the bat like he did during his rookie year when he hit 23 home runs. So if you go through that position player grouping, you know, I think there's a whole lot of room for improvement there. Rene Rivera, for me, a 31-year-old catcher who may have stolen the show this year for them, found his way to the big leagues for good. And finally, you know, he led the big leagues in catchers caught stealing this year. He's thrown out 29 guys. He's hit with a little bit of power. Yasmani Grandal, coming off a devastating knee injury last year, is caught, played some first base. I think he'll be able to catch a little bit more next year. So there's some interesting pieces. Alexi Amarista's filled in admirably at shortstop, a difficult position to play when you just throw somebody out there forever, Cabrera, and I'm not sure if we've seen the last of him. So, you know, there's some interesting pieces, some interesting National League bench pieces that I'm not sure really pegged to be everyday players. So that's going to be the challenge for the Padres moving forward, determining which of these guys stay, which don't, who better fits on the bench, and who should be in the minor leagues.
Oh, Corey, because they have pitching and they have pitching depth, quality pitching, do you feel that A.J. Preller will be able to make enough moves to get them competitive in the NL West next year, or is it a two-year plan? How do you look at it?
Well, and that's a good question. You know, and they gave him 5 years, Richard, which is relatively unheard of for a first-year general manager and a big leap of faith for the Padres, but you know, certainly he'd rather win sooner rather than later, but I don't think this isn't something that could be done overnight. We've seen these teams go from a bottom to top quickly, but it's hard to sustain that. Certainly anything's possible in the wild, wild west, as we've seen before, but the Dodgers and Giants, you know, as we've seen the last couple of years, have shown to have some staying power. So I think it's going to be a series of, I wouldn't call them smaller moves, but some kind of below the radar moves that may rate as important later on. But I really think that they're going to have to move one of these starting pitchers, and maybe Andrew Kastner, the pride of Conroe, Texas, Richard. They may have to, they approached him last year about a contract extension. His representation declined at that point for whatever reason. And, you know, if they need to find themselves some offense, this may be a place where they may be a guy that they have to move. They would hate to do it, you know, and he's bounced back from injury this year, and he's been dynamite as of late. But, again, in order to get something, you got to give up something, and he is a very hot commodity.
Corey, did you see A.J. Preller and Buddy Black, did they hit it off? I mean, A.J. decided he wants Buddy to remain as his manager. How have you seen that relationship play out?
Yeah, you know, I know they've had several meetings. It's just really casual, you know, going out to dinner after a game in Arizona shortly after A.J. became the general manager, and real informal settings and conversations and just talking baseball, talking philosophy, and I'm sure they'll get a little bit more of a chance to sit down formally once the season ends. But I think it sounds like it's a really good vibe, and it's generally a very good vibe when you sit down with Buddy Black to talk baseball anyway. I mean, it's your guy who, I've been around him for 8 years now, and I've yet to run upon anybody who's had a bad experience with him. And he's certainly not someone that's disingenuous. So, you know, I think every experience that people have had with him has been a good one for good reason. I think, you know, he wants to win here. You know, he's a San Diego guy. He makes his home here. He made his home here when he was working in Anaheim and won a World Series up there. He went to San Diego State. He'd love nothing more than to bring a winner to San Diego. You know, got close to the playoffs in 07 and 010. And, there's a pride element there. And, I think they'd work well moving forward. And I think one of the things about AJ that's impressed me, and I've heard this about him going through the interview process and talking to people for the profile I did on him, is, you know, he really empowers his employees, and he asks a lot of questions of people. And he asks a lot of questions of people who are employees. You know, he wants to know from people who have been around the Padres, let's say. He asked me questions, you know, and asked others questions. And so he's trying to get a real feel for the landscape of what's going on here, and so he could set a foundation as to what needs to happen next. So, I think that'll be a good marriage for the Padres and for Preller and Black.
Well, it'll be fascinating. It'll be interesting to see how the roster evolves during the offseason. I appreciate your time, Corey, and we'll talk to you down the road.
I am joined by my colleague Thomas Harding, who has relentlessly covered this team the entire season for MLB.com. And I would first like to offer my congratulations on making it to the finish line. And, when the air gets a little cooler and things start winding down and your team is not in contention, September can be a very long month. But we have professionals at MLB.com. Any day you are covering a baseball game at a Major League Stadium is a very good day. Thomas, would you agree with that?
I would agree totally. I mean, you know, you start any day the sun comes up and you see it, it's a great day. And when there's baseball, it's even better. It doesn't matter how far the TV cover is below 500. You've got baseball going on in front of you. And, yeah, you do kind of miss and long for the days when every pitch really matters. But, hey, those days come too.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Rockies have had quite a nice little history of postseason runs. So now they're in a position where they're going to look for next year, and they're going to start their off-season meetings, I'm sure, right away, and start planning for 2015 and spring training. So let's go over some of the things that they might be discussing. First of all, would you say that, the Rockies have said many times that they would have had a pretty decent season if not for all the injuries. And while injuries have seemed to have decimated so many teams, or at least challenged them, even the ones that are contenders, the Rockies seem to have really gotten the brunt of a lot of it. And would you say that had it not been for all these injuries, that they would have been a contender?
I'm not sure about that. I would say, though, that when you have a Troy Tulowitzki in the lineup, a Carlos Gonzalez being effective, guys like that really make a difference. I mean, Nolan Arenado's gone through a few things. And really, the season didn't fall apart until late May when Arenado got hurt. That seemed to be the injury that tipped things in this direction. So offensively, that team was a playoff team. There's no doubt in my mind. When you look at, though, what happened to the starting pitching staff also, maybe if Joey Chacin is there the whole time, if Jordan Lyles, who really developed did miss a few months with a broken left hand. So they had a lot of injuries. They had a lot of odd injuries, whether it's two pitchers breaking their left hand or them pulling a benign tumor out of Carlos Gonzalez's finger. You know, any number of odd injuries. The problem, though, that I have with that is the bullpen did not perform anywhere near what they expected going in. A couple of things happened. I believe Boone Logan was their big signing, and Boone ended up with elbow problems. He actually had an elbow surgery at the end of last year, and they signed him to a 3-year deal thinking he would be healthy, but he really had to recover from last year's surgery. And then you had Rex Brothers, the guy they expected to be the closer. He didn't perform very well at all season. He went from a ERA below 2 to just a guy that you really had a hard time trusting to get outs in a ball game. So they would have had to have made some moves along the line to make a difference and actually contend. So, yes, you could see where they were hurt by injuries, but also you could see that they weren't quite a contender and they would have had to make some shrewd moves during the season to be one.
Yeah, that's interesting on Chassin because I don't think we've really talked about him a lot, but his absence from that rotation, that was pretty big. And with a labrum tear, he's got some rotator cuff damage, but they didn't do any surgery. They opted for, like, strengthening and rehab program, and I don't know. I'm skeptical. Call me a curmudgeon, but I just feel like that never works out, and eventually they do need to have surgery. But he seems to be pretty primed to start, like, to pitch in winter ball in Venezuela. What do you think? I mean, you think that he can avoid surgery and get back on the major league mound someday?
Well, if you look at every pitcher, there is a tear in their labrum, and pretty much every pitcher has ligament damage. The question is, can you build around it and continue to pitch? Eventually, maybe he will need that surgery, but when does eventually come is the question. If you change your workout regimen, if you do things that maybe you hadn't done early in your career, and it seems like pitchers are always changing their regimen, they may be able to avoid it for a period of time. We're talking about a couple of years in there. You know, so many pitchers end up having the surgery that you'll say that eventually he'll need surgery, but can he come back and pitch now? And watching what he's gone through to rehab it and some of the changes that he's made, maybe the old program that he was on, you know, maybe that didn't really address some of the problems, and he can skate through this for another couple of years. If the velocity comes back and the command comes back, I think that you've got a decent pitcher there, and you've got a guy to pitch at the front of the rotation for a while, and all you do is just cross your fingers and hope that the final tear doesn't come.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I don't think people realize that, like you said, I mean, every pitcher has some sort of tear. Pitching is the most unnatural motion in sports. I remember when Jimmy Williams was managing the Astros, he said the most natural motion is an underhanded pitch.
Right.
What these guys do, it's so violent on the shoulders, and they do it, and they throw it, you know, 100 times in a game, and they're going at 90 miles an hour. That takes its toll pretty early.
Yes, it does. I mean, if you go back to the very beginnings of baseball, pitchers were about 50 feet from the batter, and they had to throw underhanded, and they couldn't break their wrist or make the ball or anything, and that's where this game began. Of course, you know, you would imagine that if you are a pitcher, you're like, this is for the birds, I need to find a new way. And ever since then, we've been dealing with pitchers' arm problems, and I think it's gotten even worse now, because the measure of whether you even get the opportunity is your velocity, even though that's not the most important thing in pitching. So you're going to constantly see pitchers with elbow and shoulder problems.
So now let's talk about some of the guys that are making a ton of money for the Rockies and might not actually be in the long-term plans. I still am very skeptical on this part, too, because I just, you know, they can make some trades and sort of fortify other areas. But when it comes to these huge contracts, I mean, that's a big part of it, is finding a team that wants to take on that contract and give up the prospects. And, of course, that means that, you know, they wouldn't have to absorb as much of the contract, you know, as they normally would if they can get better prospects. But it just seems like that would be an extremely difficult thing to do, especially with Tulowitzki, who is not only making a ton of money, is also not healthy. So do they really need to deal him to be able to sort of maybe solidify things for the next couple of years and be competitive?
You know, I don't think so, because if you think that you were relatively close, I can't see dealing Troy Tulowitzki and saying that you're closer because of what he means to the middle of your infield. You do have Carlos Gonzalez, who's making a little bit less money, but he also has that injury situation that you watch. I would probably say that if you're going to deal somebody, it would be more Carlos Gonzalez than Troy Tulowitzki, and even then, I'm not sure. I mean, because if you deal Gonzalez, you do have some strength in your outfield. Then you may have to make a decision on Michael Kadire, who's a free agent, but I don't think you can deal Gonzalez soon enough to sign Kadire back to keep the team in depth. I would think you would go a little bit lower on the scale there. Maybe you look at a Willian Rosario, who at the end of the season, some of the powers come back. He's had a lot of hand injuries, and really, if you look at him, you look at an American League catcher, a guy who's a multi-position player, DH sometimes, and he could be valuable that way. Maybe he could get you something back. Another guy that I would look at if I were trying to make some sort of move is Drew Stubbs. They got Stubbs from the Indians for Josh Altman, the left-handed reliever, and maybe a guy like that could help your bullpen by making a deal there. He's in the arbitration process. He's going to make pretty good money, and he's really coming off of a good year at a spot where the Rockies have a lot of players. So I would first look a little bit lower on the scale and see if I could do something there to shore up the bullpen and maybe not touch Tulowitzki and Carlos Gonzalez right now.
Is there any worry in the organization? I mean, you hear little bits and pieces here and there just about Tulowitzki. Like, is he going to eventually just get tired of this and want to go play for a winner? I can't see him like really making a big stink out of it and, you know, taking it publicly, which sort of forces the hand of the team. But is there any concern there that he's just going to be sort of, a little discontented and want to maybe play for a team that wins?
I think he wants to play for a team that wins. The priority is here, though. Let's face it, he signed through 2020, and he understands that. I remember there was some stuff around the All-Star game where he talked to Matt Holliday about the future and what it's like to contend and things like that. But when Matt Holliday was dealt from here, he did not have that long-term contract. So Tulowitzki did commit, and he understands there's some meaning to that commitment. For him to kind of work his way out of here, I don't think it's at that point yet. I think another season or two where it's absolutely horrible, it may be unbearable for him, and he may go public. Right now, when he does go public and he talks about, hey, I want to win, he's talking about trying to win here. He's talking about making the moves here, hoping guys get better around him. And he hasn't attempted to force his way out at this point. I don't think that's an immediate concern right now.
Well, that's good for Rockies fans. We'll see. I mean, 2020, that's so far away. When you put it in those terms, it seems like
Yes. He's
going to be there for a while. So even if anything happens, it could be a few years before he tries to, you know, start knocking on the door to get out of there.
He doesn't have that no-trade clause. He's not, and usually when you have the no-trade clause, you can kind of use that by going to the organization and say, hey, there are certain teams. They have guys. I'm not going to engineer this exactly, but you know that they have guys who can help, and maybe you want to send me here as opposed to another place. But with no rights in that respect, it's kind of hard for him to even demand a trade because who knows? He could be sent anywhere, somewhere that he doesn't want to go.
So is there money available for free agents? And if so, do they have a wish list or priorities where they want to start plugging people in?
Michael Kadire, his contract comes off the books at the end of the season, and I think they can use some of that money to fill some other holes. When you look at this team, are they ever going to sign the top-level free agent pitcher? The question is no. I mean, the answer is no to that one. So what you look at is, you build your bullpen. Maybe even if you want to deal a Willian Rosario, you go out and try to sign a guy. Russell Martin seems to be the guy that everyone talks about. And, man, I'd love to be Russell Martin right now with the way he's finishing the season and with free agency coming and the Pirates really wanting to keep him there. He's going to be a rich man at the end of the season. So if the Rockies are going to spend, it will probably be trying to bid on a Russell Martin type guy. But if they don't, you build your bullpen. Maybe you get another starter. Maybe even you make a creative trade to get yourself another starter. And after that, though, you look at this team and the way it's structured and the payroll, what you're looking at is a team that's always going to be pretty young in the starting rotation because they're not going to spend huge dollars, and they're going to be pretty young on the bench. So you're not going to go out and sign a guy like a veteran bat off the bench type guy. So you just look and see if you can fill here and there, and you really have to depend on the guys you have getting better.
Well, we'll keep our eye on it. And, Thomas, thank you so much for your participation this season and for making this a fun 15 minutes. So appreciate everything, and enjoy that first day of the off season. It's always, you know, a pretty good day, too. So kick back and relax a little bit, and we will catch up with you soon. I'm joined by my colleague Steve Gilbert, who has covered the Diamondbacks for MLB.com since the very, very beginning. So he has seen a lot of people come in and out of this organization, and he has seen the team do really well, and he's seen the team not do so well and look toward next season, and that's kind of where we are right now. So, Steve, let's talk about 2015 and looking ahead to what the new general manager, whoever that might be, is going to be doing for next year. And talk about some of these younger players. I mean, as you know, the Diamondbacks have had kind of a rough season, but they've had a few shining stars, you know, guys that have really made cases for themselves to be in good position to have jobs next year. Maybe we should start with Chase Anderson. But, what have you seen from some of these young guys? And going into next season, what can they, you know, kind of contribute for next year?
Sure, Allison. I think, you know, the main question for the new general manager and for the ownership group is, do they feel like this team can compete in 2015, can realistically compete in 2015? You know, they had $110 million payroll going into this year. They're going to have a high payroll regardless just from the players they have coming back. Do they feel like with the return to health, say, Patrick Corbin and David Hernandez and, you know, getting Paul Goldschmidt back and having Trumbo, you know, hopefully for them for a whole season, you know, does that kind of put them back in the National West race, or do they need to do more of an in-depth rebuilding type job? And I think once they answer that question, then it becomes, you know, then their off-season priorities come more into focus. You brought up, Chase Anderson is a great example of a young pitcher who took advantage of the injuries and the struggles of a Trevor Cahill and came up and really pitched well. He came up at the beginning of May and was one of their most consistent starters all year long. And is somebody who certainly has pitched his way into the conversation for next year, if not deserving of the right to be penciled in heading into spring training.
Well, it's funny because I've been looking all over and just reading a lot of coverage from a lot of different teams, and everybody's kind of getting shut down as far as pitchers go. Very few guys are actually that were in the rotation, you know, semi-regularly even if they were, like, called up in the middle of the season, they are not being permitted to actually finish out the season. And I think that's smart. You know, you don't want to, in a lost season especially, I mean, you don't want to push these guys and risk injury. It's just funny because, you know, everyone has to have their arms protected so much basically because they're so valuable, and it's just an expensive thing to employ baseball players these days. But it's a smart thing, right? I mean, on the flip side, if you're playing a contender, it's kind of like, you know, you need to throw your best guys out there, but you can't do that to, you know, risk these young arms.
Absolutely. And the Diamondbacks kind of walk that fine line with Anderson. On the one hand, they wanted him to pitch, you know, into September and, you know, farther into September so that hopefully in the future he would have the experience of having done that and so that he could pitch a full season. By the same token, they were a little nervous about it, how high his innings totals were getting. So they skipped him a turn after the All-Star break. They went to a six-man rotation in September and then shut him down here with a week to go so he doesn't make his last start. So in that way, they kind of try to walk that fine line because you're right, a lot of teams are looking at their younger pitchers and just, you know, they don't want to push it. And especially if you're not on a pennant contending team, why risk the injury? It's the same reason why they shut Daniel Hudson down after he came back now from two Tommy John surgeries and appeared in three games in relief. They had initially thought, hey, maybe we can get him 4 to 6 appearances, and then realized after three that he was feeling good, that he, you know, shown what he could do, and that they would quit while they were ahead and let him rest up for next year.
You know, it's interesting because there's like two sides of the whole September call-up story. So on one hand, I mean, it sort of feels like spring training again with some of these teams that have 35 guys on their roster and they're doing matchups in the bullpen for every single batter. And that doesn't seem quite fair because it's almost like that's really not the team that you've had all season. And when you're playing a contender, I don't know. It kind of bothers me that they're, you know, when these guys are trying to get in the playoffs and they're playing a non-contender, and it just changes the whole dynamic. At the same time, you do want to have enough guys up to be able to protect some of these arms. So I don't know. I mean, I was always in favor of maybe just having like a 30-player limit for a September roster. What do you think?
And, you know, that's a great idea as a way of, you know, maybe making it 30 members, you know, per game. You can only have 30 per game. Maybe you can, you know, switch it up on a day-to-day basis, but not where you're, you know, have 40 players at your disposal during, or maybe you designate 25 and you can change that from game to game, but not have all 40 of your guys eligible. Because you're right, it does change things. And the Diamondbacks have been really cognizant, I think, of, you know, when they're playing a contending team, that they can't just run a tryout camp out there, that they do play some of their regulars, you know, in a series like now, when they're playing the Twins, both teams out of the race, I think they're more willing to give a guy like, you know, Bobby Wilson a start behind the plate or some other people that might not get a chance to play very often. But when they're playing a contender, Kirk Gibson has said that, you know, they feel like they owe it to, you know, it sounds corny, but they owe it to the game of baseball to you know, run a representative lineup out there, you know, in fairness.
Yeah, and especially if they're trying to knock some playoff dreams out, like from some of their rivals. You know, they want to absolutely put their best players out there when they're playing a team, maybe like the Dodgers. I'm just speculating on that. Let's talk about Mark Trumbo a little bit. You know, he's affordable. I mean, he's got 2 years of arbitration, if I'm correct on this, and he's not a free agent until 2017. But clearly, when they brought him to the organization, they had a little bit more in mind. He's not the home run hitter that they were counting on when they traded for him. So what to do with him? Bring him back, try to deal him? What do you think?
It's a great question. You know, they had counted on him to kind of provide, you know, protection in the lineup for Paul Goldschmidt. And he got hurt right out of the chute and just never was fully right. And then when Goldschmidt got hurt, they moved him to first base. Left field, he's looked a little shaky. Part of that was his injury and not being able to move around as well. So I think they have to make a decision this winter. Do they feel like he can play left field? Because if you're a first baseman in this organization, your name's not Paul Goldschmidt, you're not going to play very often. So if they feel like he can play left field, you know, they probably bring him back. Because if they were to trade him or deal him now, coming off this kind of injury plague season, I think they'd be dealing him at a real low end of his value. So that's something they're going to have to really look at and decide, do they feel like that he can be at least an average left fielder.
And now there's the Aaron Hill conundrum. So he's got 2 years and $24 million left on his contract, which is kind of mind-boggling, and he's not having a great season at 241. You know, he's a natural second baseman that he might move to third base. Is it a relatively untradeable contract? He's being a good team player. I mean, everything that you read, he's like totally willing to do whatever the team wants him to do. What do you think they should do with him?
Well, you know, I think that you pointed out $24 million for Aaron Hill right now. That's not a contract that you can easily trade. I mean, you might actually have to eat, you know, $18 million of that to trade him. And so for me, if it were me, and again, it's far out of my pay grade, but if it were me, I would try to bank on the fact that he's going to have a little bit of a comeback and try to at least cover spring training with him as your second baseman. Because again, you're just not going to be able to trade him without eating all that money. And it just doesn't make sense to eat all that money rather than at least take a chance and see if he can be productive at least at the beginning of next season at second base. Or if you really want to go with, you know, Chris Owings at second and Didi Gregorius at short, then let him play third, although, you know, you've got Jake Lamb, so then you start, you know, bumping up against that. So for me, I bring him back and put him at second and put Owings at short, at least to start the season and see if he can have a rebound season like he did for the Diamondbacks in 2012.
So do you think that Kirk Gibson is sort of just sitting and waiting to hear what might be with him? Is this kind of weird time for him, or does he feel I mean, I don't know. He's been around the game forever, so I'm sure he's seen just about everything. But what do you think is going to happen with that? You think there's going to be some kind of announcement right after the season?
Yeah, you know, I think that's something that Tony La Russa had hoped to have decided, you know, when the team plays its last game on Sunday. So it'll come soon, but I think he's in a waiting period, a holding pattern right here. And that's certainly got to weigh on the guy's mind, even if he says it doesn't, I'm sure, because, you know, you don't know what your status is going to be for next year, and that's just got to be a little disconcerting.
Yeah, that's the side of the game that is not a lot of fun. It's really great to work in baseball, but it's so volatile, and, you know, at any moment, things can just change on a dime, which is, it's just got to be, it's just an awkward situation. I mean, not awkward, but just strange, you know, to have this winding down and everyone saying their goodbyes, and you don't know if it's goodbye or like goodbye, I'll see you next spring, or
right,
you know,
and it's not just,
knows.
You know, and the decision with him then affects the coaching staff as well, so it's like a trickle down effect, and they're all waiting to see where they're, you know, where they're going to be next year. So they hope to have that a little bit a little more clarity to that going into that last game on Sunday. So we should hear soon about Kirk Gibson's status for next year.
All right. Well, we will be paying attention. And Steve, thank you for all of your participation with these podcasts. Appreciate it. And we'll check in with you this offseason, I'm sure. Thanks for listening to MLB.com Extras, the NL West.